Hi friends, before we jump into today's episode, I want to thank you for choosing to listen to the surprising rebirth of Belief in God. We'll soon be celebrating 500,000 downloads since launch and winning a Zenga Prize for podcast journalism. If you're enjoying the series and you'd like to help me reach even more people with thinking faith, can I encourage you to support this podcast? Becoming a silver supporter means you get early access to episodes and bonus content. Gold supporters also get signed books and a monthly catch-up with me on Zoom, if you'd like it. The links to support are with the show notes, or visit justinbriley.com. Enjoy today's episode.
It is the laziest way of accounting for observations. In biology, you delve down into, if you like, the chemistry of the organism. In chemistry, you delve down into the physics of the underlying processes. And, I accept, maybe in physics, you have to delve down into the underlying mathematical fabric of whatever I mean by that.
This is atheist scientist Peter Atkins, a notable Oxford professor of chemistry, speaking on God and science.
It's jolly hard work. And you've got to work on it. But it's more satisfying when you get to the end of an explanation than that extraordinarily lazy way of pretending to explain by saying, and abracadabra, God did it.
Atkins had joined me for a university debate I was hosting between him and another Oxford professor of mathematics and science, Christian thinker John Lennox.
Why am I passionate about science? Why do I believe science can be done? Well, because I believe that in some way the human mind in here has access to the natural world out there. Modern science exploded in the 16th and 17th centuries, and its pioneers, Galileo, Kepler, Newton, Clerk Maxwell, and so on, were all believers in God, most of them Christian. And the point is, it was their belief in God that didn't hinder their science. It was the motor that drove it.
Lennox and Atkins engaged in a spirited debate, but it wasn't the first time I'd brought Peter Atkins into a lively conversation. As a particularly outspoken atheist, he's well known for his brash style, deriding the faith claims of any believing scientist as lazy thinking, poppycock, or worse. On one occasion, I invited him onto the Premier Unbelievable show to debate the origin of the laws of the universe with Hugh Ross, a leading Christian astrophysicist. During their debate on whether there was a creator behind the universe, one part of the conversation particularly remained with me.
Some people might accuse you of being so committed to atheism that you'd never be willing to countenance any evidence that might lend support to a creator behind the universe. So I'm just interested, what sort of evidence could science or the physical universe present to you that would make you think actually that that is evidence that there's a mind behind this?
I mean, a very difficult question. If I were looking in the Bible for evidence, heaven forbid, I would expect to see maybe increase in entropy is equal to Q reversible divided by temperature. That is,
if there was literally an equation in the Bible,
The Bible, rather than all this wishy-washy, okay, elastic writing that it pervades.
All right, so if there was something like that that they discovered, yeah, in the Bible,
then I think it was probably a forgery.
Well, exactly. The problem is, would it actually make you? No. I mean, is there anything from, you know, is there any kind of evidence in the universe that could make, I mean, if the stars lined up to spell, Peter, please believe in me, it's about time.
I put it down to madness.
You put it down, so
to personal madness.
Right.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like, Peter, that there's no evidence that would persuade you away from atheism.
Well, to be honest, I think that's probably the case.
In that sense, do you even have an evidence-based view if you're actually committed to atheism a priori?
Well, I'm predicting that there will be no such evidence. That's not quite the same thing as
being committed to it a priori. I can't.
But you said there's no evidence that would persuade you otherwise.
I think it's much more likely that I would have gone mad than such evidence would have been provided.
Right. So in principle, it's impossible to ever persuade you that God exists.
I didn't quite say that, but...
Well, what would persuade you?
I can't conceive of... I suppose even if I died and was confronted with, you know, St. Peter saying, "Welcome to heaven," I'd probably think I was dreaming.
I think Atkins' very honest answer was revealing. I could probably have given him a dozen more lines of hypothetical evidence for God and be met with a similar naturalistic explanation. Even those who claim to follow the evidence may have erected invisible barriers that cannot be crossed. Some types of explanation are simply off the table for them. And for someone like Atkins, the God explanation is simply unthinkable. It's one of the reasons why I believe that the debate over God and science is about more than just evidence and argument. It's about your worldview, what you are and aren't prepared to accept as an explanation of reality. The reality is that science, as a tool for investigating the world, is neutral. But scientists are not. Scientists are as human as anyone else when it comes to their biases, preferences, and assumptions about life. The problem isn't necessarily with the quality of the scientific evidence produced, it's with the interpretive filter we use to process that evidence. Like many of the new atheists we've met in this series, such as Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris, Atkins is a believer in scientific materialism, that all of reality is ultimately reducible to the impersonal forces of biology, chemistry, and physics. Atkins' worldview could equally be described as scientism, in which the only plausible explanations are physical, scientific ones. His a priori commitment to a purely naturalistic worldview means that supernatural explanations are out of the question. Providing more evidence wouldn't budge him one iota. For Atkins to stop being an atheist would doubtless involve something altogether different. Yet, if we can maintain an open mind and refuse to allow reason to be conflated with scientism, we may discover that the progress of science actually provides an abundance of evidence that points towards God rather than towards atheism. In fact, I believe that in recent decades, despite everything you may have heard in the era of the new atheists, a surprising rebirth of belief in God is underway in the realm of science itself. I'm Justin Brierley, and throughout my working life, I've been hosting conversations on faith between atheists, agnostics, and believers. In this documentary series, I'm telling the story of why new atheism grew old and secular thinkers are considering Christianity again. I'm speaking to those inside and outside the atheist movement and the many new thinkers beginning a new conversation on the value of faith. Along the way, we'll meet some of those who have found themselves surprised by God as they've made the journey from atheism to Christianity. Welcome to The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God, Episode 18, The Alternative Story of Science. Just before we jump into the rest of today's show, one of the voices you'll hear on this podcast is friend of the show Glenn Scrivener, a brilliant Christian communicator. Glenn has recently put together an online course called 321. It's an introduction to Christianity that's imaginative, stimulating, and assumes no prior knowledge. If you've been thinking about exploring faith for yourself, or if you want something to share with your friends, 321 is just the thing. Glenn presents 8 video-led sessions which are beautifully shot and animated. I found it a really engaging and practical way of connecting the big ideas in this podcast to our everyday life. I'm already thinking of people I can share it with. See for yourself at 321course.com/ JB. It's completely free. Just start a free account with your email and a password and you're in. There's no spam, no hidden costs. Go to 321course.com/JB and discover life according to Jesus.
I view religions as essentially failed sciences. I mean, the religion was the discourse that we had when all causes in the universe were opaque. We didn't know the basis of anything.
This is Sam Harris during the heyday of New Atheism in the mid-2000s, speaking on science versus faith.
We didn't know the basis of anything. We didn't know why we were here. We didn't know how diseases spread or what disease was. We didn't know how people, why people died early and why others flourished. We don't know what's causing the thunderstorms or causing crops to fail. And we very naturally, as a cognitive and behavioral imperative, we form descriptions of the world and we try to figure out what's going on. So we have, you know, this parent figure in the sky who's going to take care of things if you live rightly. And we have other demonic presences that we should be really worried about. And gradually, what you see happening is that religion, as rationality and dozens of specific sciences were birthed in the human conversation, you see religion on 100 fronts losing the argument with science.
The books, articles, videos, and lectures of Harris and his New Atheist peers set the tone for much of the early 21st century when it came to the relationship between science and faith. This is Richard Dawkins appearing on Real Time with Bill Maher.
Well, I know people say to me all the time, why can't we reconcile science and faith? And, you know, we went through this with George Bush when he said we should teach evolution as well as creationism side by side. But
teach the controversy.
right, that's what they call it. You really can't have it both ways, can you?
Faith is the very opposite of science. Faith is belief in something without evidence. Right. Science insists all the time on evidence. It's based upon evidence, logical reasoning from evidence. Faith and science are completely incompatible.
Not only was faith incompatible with science, said the New Atheist, but any scientific pioneers who professed faith were simply products of their Christian age. This is atheist physicist Lawrence Krauss speaking on the Joe Rogan podcast.
No doubt. Religious ideas, and all our early scientists were religious because it was the only game in town. You couldn't be educated except the church controlled all the universities, and so it was like the National Science Foundation of the 16th century. It's not surprising they were all religious because that was the only game in town. So that helped create the birth of modern science, but science outgrew it. And that's okay. Kids outgrow their parents. Thank goodness.
But more than simply being wrong about science, the major claim of many new atheists was that the church has historically actively blocked the progress of science and free inquiry. This is the late Christopher Hitchens in a 2009 debate on whether the Catholic Church is a force for good.
A whole series of preceding apologies, or apologies I would say of a kind, made by the late Pope John Paul, who, it troubles me not at all to say, was a very impressive and serious human being. It followed no less than 94, count them, public recognitions on his part of appalling crime and error and cruelty and stupidity and offences to the free intelligence, ranging from, I shall be summary, like Bishop Marini, the African slave trade apologised for in 1995, the admission that Galileo was right about the relationship between the sun and the earth and other orbs, which came in 1992, one might add. No, I won't say. It's too easy to say better late than never. Here, said it.
We'll return to the famous trial of Galileo shortly, but across these clips, Hitchens, Dawkins, Harris and Krauss were all playing into what has often been dubbed the conflict thesis of science and faith. This was one of the trump cards of the new atheism. Religion was a relic of the superstitious past, atheism and science were the future. It's something that you'll continue to bump into all the time, an assumed fact about history to very many. In fact, the Pew Research Center reported in 2021 that 56% of Americans believe there is a conflict between science and religion. Likewise, a 2022 study showed that 57% of Brits think that science and religion are incompatible. So, as we begin the fifth act of our documentary series, focused on the rebirth of belief in God in the scientific realm, it's important to begin by interrogating the real history of science and faith. And our first question should be, where did this conflict thesis actually originate?
And the conflict thesis is also known as the Draper-White thesis.
This is historian Tim O'Neill speaking on the Capturing Christianity podcast.
And it's effectively that throughout human history, particularly throughout Western history, religion and science have been in conflict. Religion has constantly been trying to drag scientific and also technological development back and retard progress because it dislikes science. It is against reason. It's based on faith and tradition and superstition, and it's inherently conservative. Whereas science is constantly striving to take humanity forward. And this has been quite prevalent idea, which has been around since about the 18th century.
We've met Tim O'Neill before in this series. A non-believer himself, he runs the website History for Atheists. But unlike his new atheist peers, he's set himself the task of debunking the bad historical takes that have proliferated in skeptical books and websites in the past few decades. But who are the Draper and White that O'Neill began by mentioning? Arguably, they were the original creators of fake news when it comes to science and faith. John William Draper and Andrew Dixon White were two quirky 19th century historians whose pamphlets on the so-called conflict thesis became wildly popular. John William Draper was a scientist, historian, and early pioneer of photography, but he's best remembered for his popular book, The History of the Conflict Between Religion and Science. Andrew Dixon White was a historian and educator who co-founded Cornell University and wrote another influential 800-page book, The History of the Warfare of Science with Theology in Christendom. Both were full of purported examples of the way in which the Catholic Church in particular was deemed to have held back the advance of science. It's hard to exaggerate how much their ideas have informed modern perceptions of the relationship between science and faith. Tim O'Neill.
It's often sometimes also called the warfare thesis, the warfare between theology or religion and science, and how this has been going on for centuries. The only problem with the Draper-White thesis, despite the fact it's extremely popular, is that it's wrong. And actual historians of science have rejected it for almost 100 years now. So what they argue is that it's too simplistic. What it does is it takes some episodes of conflict between religion or theology and science, and then extrapolates those out to be the entire story, whereas the model that most historians of science now accept is sometimes called the complexity thesis, which basically says, in the words of the old Facebook relationship status, it's complicated. So the idea is that the relationship between religion and science has sometimes been in conflict. Sometimes it's been highly fruitful. A hell of a lot of the time, in fact, most of the time, it's been completely neutral. So the idea that science and religion are always in conflict and have always been so is not a respectable idea among historians.
Among the many assertions by Draper and White were claims that Christians defended a flat earth theory against the scientific consensus, that they ushered in the Dark Ages by destroying ancient libraries, that they were opposed to learning about biological forms through dissection, and that the early Protestant reformers opposed modern astronomical theories. Physicist David Hutchings is a co-author with James Unguranu of the book Of Popes and Unicorns, Science, Christianity, and How the Conflict Thesis Fooled the World. He told me how the myths promoted by White and Draper seemed to be concocted from extremely questionable sources.
You get quite a lot of examples of these backward stories. So another one is that Andrew Dixon White says, this is a following passage from his book, that John Calvin, the theologian, wrote, "Who will venture to place the authority of Copernicus above that of the Holy Spirit?" So White gives this quote. And there's a crucial difference between White and Draper. Draper has no footnotes in his book at all. So when he writes down a quote, you don't know where it's come from, and it can be quite hard to track it down. But White, you can see, again, your YouTube viewers will be able to tell more. His book's two volumes. It's 500 pages of footnotes. So you can do a bit of detective work. And one of the fun things for James and for me has been doing a bit of detective work on White. Where did he get this stuff from? And sometimes his quotes are genuine fabrications. They are fabrications. And sometimes you can track them back one generation or two generations, and then they turn to dust. They don't exist. And so this Calvin one is interesting because Calvin never wrote about Copernicus once in any of his work. So this footnote turned to dust. You could only track it back about 30 or 40 years earlier. But here's what Calvin did say. "The study of astronomy not only gives pleasure, but is also extremely useful. And no one can deny that it admirably reveals the wisdom of God. Therefore, clever men who expend their labour upon it are to be praised. And those who have ability and leisure ought not to neglect work of that kind." So you find these upside down, backwards stories in Draper and White over and over and over again.
The amazing thing is that even today, White and Draper's fabricated ideas and quotes are still being circulated as facts in respectable journals and educational resources.
But you asked earlier, you know, where do we find them now? I found quotations of White in a Senate hearing. I found quotations of them on the BBC Bite Size website, which is a revision website in the UK for teenagers. Wow. I found them in the Journal of the American Medical Association. And then also a chap called Michael Newton Keyes, he did a study of college textbooks in the US, college and high school textbooks, and he found that as many as 71% of American textbooks at college and high school were spreading these Draper and Whiteisms, as we've started to call them.
Gosh.
Without knowing where they came from. They came from.
Little wonder, with so much disinformation circulating from the 19th century onwards, that the new atheists picked up and ran with the conflict thesis established by Draper and White. O'Neill says he commonly encounters atheists who claim that the church has been in conflict with science since medieval times.
I've always done this. I've always said, can you give me one example? And they always say Galileo. To which I say, well, Galileo was a contemporary of Descartes. Galileo lived in the 16th century. That's not medieval. Now, if they were oppressing scientists for the 1,000-year period before Galileo, you should be able to give me an example that's actually in the Middle Ages. And they never can, because it didn't happen. So what actually happened in the Middle Ages was, because Augustine and Clement and those guys had won the debate, and because, as I mentioned, they had pretty much established that pagan learning was a good thing and it could be used, in fact, made it the foundation of their entire education system. What actually happened was that there was really no conflict between science and religion in the Middle Ages.
But as Tim O'Neill said earlier, the history is complicated. So let's examine perhaps the most famous claim, the trial of Galileo Galilei in 1633. Was Christopher Hitchens correct to castigate the church for suppressing and persecuting Galileo for his claim that the earth revolves around the sun? It's true, Galileo was censured by the Catholic Church for promoting heliocentrism, the Copernican view of our solar system, which would eventually overturn the idea that the Earth was at the centre of the planetary movements. But historians have pointed out that at the time, the Copernican theory that the Sun was at the centre was still one among many theories under examination.
On the eve of his first trial in 1615, the inquisitor who ended up trying Galileo in 1616, the next year, Cardinal Bellarmine, wrote a very famous open letter, a public letter, addressing the question of whether or not heliocentrism, the idea of the sun being at the centre, could be accepted on both scientific and theological grounds. And he said, as Mike has alluded, he said, if it can be demonstrated that this is so, then we would have to proceed with great caution in the way in which we interpreted certain texts of the Bible. So he said, effectively, we're open to that. But he was a conservative. He said, but no such demonstration has been shown to me. It wasn't until Newton came along that solved the physical problems, the problems of physics, with a lot of the stuff that was around heliocentrism, that it was eventually Kepler's model with its elliptical orbits, which Galileo rejected, that eventually won out. That was decades after Galileo died. So the church had the best science and the consensus of science of its day on their side. And they knew it, and Galileo knew it. And that changes the whole story.
So why had Galileo, who Pope Urban VIII had generously supported as a patron, fallen into a situation where he was being tried for heresy? There are numerous mythologies around the popular version of the Galileo affair still floating around. Galileo was really an atheist forced to pay lip service to Christianity. Not true. He wrote at length about his belief in God. Galileo was tortured and executed for his theory. Again, neither is true. I sat down with John Lennox, Emeritus Professor of Mathematics and Philosophy of Science, in the tower of the Radcliffe Observatory at his own Green Templeton College at Oxford University, to talk about the history of science and faith. And I began by asking John to explain a bit more of what had actually brought Galileo into conflict with the authorities.
The Galileo story cannot be used to drive a conflict metaphor. First of all, Galileo was no atheist challenging the ignoramuses in the Roman Catholic Church. Galileo was a believer in God when he started, and he was a believer in God when he finished. And the things that irritated people about Galileo, and there were many, we'll come to those in a moment, but I think the key issue with Galileo was there he was in the name of science, and he was questioning what was established wisdom, not for the church, yes. Why? Because they had gotten the bandwagon of Aristotle, the view that the earth was the center and it didn't move. And the fact is that the first people that challenged Galileo, as I understand from having read most of the literature on it, well, not the church at all, but the philosophers. They were against it. So it was a conflict about worldview, and the church had jumped on the bandwagon because they felt the Bible would support that worldview that the earth didn't move, that some moved, but the earth didn't move. And they later reversed that, of course. So that to regard that as God versus science is false. The second thing is that Galileo insisted on writing in Italian rather than in Latin. And that irritated people, but not so much as when he wrote his famous book, he put the views of the then Pope, who had been his friend, into the words of a character called Simplicio, the fool. And of course, for PR, that was an absolute disaster. And you know, if you read Davos Sabel's wonderful book, Galileo's Daughter, you'll see that there's just no evidence that Galileo was a non-believer. there was a professor of the history of science, Colin Russell, at the Open University. He once wrote a very interesting piece where he said this conflict myth is so against history that the thing that needs to be explained is, well, where it possibly could have come from. Mm.
Galileo's trial was more about personality and politics than it ever was about science and faith. And far from being sentenced to languish in prison after an inquisitorial-style torture, as some imagine, Galileo's actual sentence involved being put under house arrest in the comfortable surroundings of his own villa, where he continued to enjoy receiving guests and to research and publish his scientific work. While we're exploding a few myths, why don't we turn to a slightly more recent episode in the history of science and faith that's also been used to dramatic effect.
I wonder, Mr. Huxley, is it through your grandfather or your grandmother that you claim descent from an ape?
Would I rather have a miserable ape for a grandfather? Intelligent, possessed of great means of influence, and yet who employed these faculties and that influence for the mere purpose of introducing ridicule into a grave scientific discussion, I unhesitatingly affirm my preference for the ape.
That was a TV dramatisation of a famous 1860 debate between Bishop Samuel Wilberforce and Charles Darwin's protégé Thomas Huxley on whether the theory of evolution was true. Their debate has often been heralded as an example of the way the church stood against evolutionary theory as a challenge to biblical creation. But as ever, things are more complicated. Huxley's and Wilberforce's debate took place at Oxford's Natural History Museum, a setting that has, in more recent years, also featured John Lennox debating atheist biologist Richard Dawkins on science and faith. I asked John about where the idea of a conflict between Darwin and the church began.
But why did that sort of anti-religious, pro-science conflict narrative emerge then around, I suppose, especially around the time of Huxley and co, there was a sense in which, was it a feeling that Darwinism now needed to trump any idea of design in biology? What was going on?
I think this is a very complex thing. Mm. It's a very interesting thing because you have, going back further, you have Newton and his wonderful laws that led people to think that the universe is like a great machine and that is determined to run on these fixed laws. And that tended to push God right to the background, to a kind of deism. God started it, the machine is like clockwork, it's ticking away. And of course, inevitably, especially with the rise of the French intellectuals and the Enlightenment in France, where they discovered that the best way of disagreeing with people was cut their heads off and you stop the disagreement, was an incipient atheism that was fueled massively by a corrupt church. Mm. So a lot of sociological factors were playing there. But then there was the rise of an elite of scientists, of whom Huxley was one. He was dead against these amateur clergymen who sat in lovely benefices out in the country in Oxfordshire here and studied butterflies and worms and this kind of stuff. Some of them were very learned people, you see. Wilberforce was one of those. But Huxley wanted a professional scientific elite. He wanted to turn the churches into temples to the goddess of wisdom, Sophia, and all this kind of thing. And so he pushed that end. And the debate with Wilberforce was skewed in terms of reportage, really by Huxley and his friends. Now, I have read the whole of what Wilberforce wrote. And the amazing thing is that Wilberforce himself states that he is not going to argue against Darwin on the basis of the Christian worldview. That's what he explicitly refuses to do. He said, I'm going to do it on the basis of science. And Darwin's comment was, he has uncommonly cleverly pointed out some of the weaknesses in my theory. Mm. So reports, there are very few that exist, and they say that they roughly had equals in what they did. But again, Colin Russell, in his article, says you cannot use this to drive a conflict narrative. Mm. Far more complex than that.
Later on in this Act of Our docu-series, we'll look in more detail at the claims by many new atheists that evolutionary theory excludes God and why the whole field of biology and the God question is actually being shaken up. For now, it's worth noting that in reality, Darwin's theory was generally welcomed by the Church of England at the time it was proposed, and episodes such as the Huxley-Wilberforce debate owe more to larger-than-life personalities than a serious pushback by the church establishment. Even before Darwin's theory, there had been teaching as far back as Origen and Augustine in the 3rd and 4th centuries that allowed for an allegorical interpretation of the creation story and a lengthy timeline for the appearance of life on Earth. The young Earth creation movement, which has been the focus of much New Atheist ire, is a relatively modern movement that only really gained prominence in the mid-20th century. But once we get beyond the popular caricatures of the science and faith debate, I believe we'll find a far more interesting alternative story being told by many modern historians about just how much science itself owes its birth and its ongoing success to the Christian story. Did you know this podcast is also a book, The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God, Why New Atheism Grew Old and Secular Thinkers Are Considering Christianity Again, is available now. Historian Tom Holland says Justin has had a ringside seat watching the great debates on religion and reports on them with learning, subtlety and grace. Now, don't tell anyone, but you'll actually get the first chapter free in your email inbox if you subscribe to my newsletter. Or if you want to just go ahead and order, signed editions are available from my website. Or even better, you'll get both my books personally signed when you become a gold supporter of this podcast. So for the newsletter, the book, or to support, check the links in the show notes or visit justinbriley.com.
Professor Dawkins, it's very good to have you join us to discuss whether it matters that Christianity is playing a diminishing role in national life. Welcome to LBC.
Thank you.
This is well-known atheist biologist Richard Dawkins being interviewed at Easter by LBC Radio.
And what would be your Easter message? I've said a few things. What would you tell the nation?
Well, I must say I was slightly horrified to hear that Ramadan is being promoted instead. I do think that we are culturally a Christian country. I call myself a cultural Christian. I'm not a believer. But there's a distinction between being a believing Christian and being a cultural Christian. And so, you know, I love hymns and Christmas carols, and I sort of feel at home in the Christian ethos. I feel that we are a Christian country in that sense. It's true that statistically the number of people who actually believe in Christianity is going down, and I'm happy with that. But I would not be happy if, for example, we lost all our cathedrals and our beautiful parish churches. So I count myself a cultural Christian. I think it would matter if we, certainly if we substituted any alternative religion, that would be truly dreadful.
Many people sent me this clip of Dawkins professing his happiness to be a cultural Christian when it went viral at Easter. Though, as one commentator said, enjoying the benefits of Christianity while wishing people would stop believing is a bit like enjoying eating freshly baked bread every day while wishing people would stop becoming bakers and opening bakeries. You'll only have the second-hand benefits of cultural Christianity if people continue to become actual Christians. Also, it's not that Dawkins has never said things like this in the past, but it does seem to fit my own sense in my book and this podcast series, The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God, that the vehement anti-religion of the new atheism is a thing of the past now. And many public thinkers are realizing that if we're going to be religious about anything, Christianity is still the best option on offer. Dawkins, of course, made his name as a scientist, and while he may profess an admiration for the cultural effects of Christianity, as we heard earlier, he believes faith is at odds with good science. But here, I think Dawkins needs to take another look at that cultural Christianity he's so fond of, because I believe that today there are increasing numbers of historians, thinkers, and scientists pointing out that the reason we can do good science is precisely because of the history of the Christian story that lies behind the scientific revolution. Let's return briefly to that conversation with Peter Atkins we heard at the beginning of today's episode. When he wrote a book called Conjuring the Universe in 2018 on why he believes the origins of the laws of nature can spring from nothing and that we have no need for God, I was intrigued that he chose to open the book with a quote from a 17th century scientist, Francis Bacon, arguably the father of the scientific method and a devout Christian. It's interesting to me, Peter, that at the beginning of your book, you quote Francis Bacon.
Very clever man.
But of course, a very devout Christian as well.
Yeah.
So were those, you know, 17th century scientists who so many of them claimed a very devout Christian faith all intellectually lazy, these people who birthed the modern science?
No, but they didn't have enough knowledge of science. Science was in its early days then. Science has only been going for, 400 years? Serious science, you know, since Galileo and Newton and so on. And the early scientists, including people like Michael Faraday in the 19th century, are exemplars in the 20th century as well, simply didn't have the whole tapestry of science before them to see what extraordinary progress it had made. And also, religious belief also depends upon cultural conditioning. And these people in the past were in environments which really supported the religious views.
I think Peter Atkins is a great chemist, but he's not a good historian. Francis Bacon was not simply a culturally conditioned Christian. He was a devout believer who wrote frequently on religion and reason, and whose faith fueled his science, as cultural critic and author Vishal Mangalwadi explains.
Psalm 111, verse 2. That's the verse which is written at the entrance of the world's first scientific laboratory in Cambridge, Cavendish Laboratory. It says, "Majestic are the works of the Lord. Those who delight in them study them." Now, this idea had already been developing in Middle Ages, which was systematized by Francis Bacon, the father of modern science. And he says there is the book of God's words, which is the Bible, and the book of God's works, everything that God has done in nature. So majestic are the works of the Lord, that we should be reading the works of God.
In fact, Francis Bacon famously wrote that a little philosophy inclineth man's mind to atheism, but depth in philosophy bringeth men's minds about to religion. It's a phrase echoed by Nobel Prize-winning physicist Werner Heisenberg, who later said, "The first gulp from the glass of natural sciences will turn you into an atheist, but at the bottom of the glass, God is waiting for you." And little wonder, because as Bishop Robert Barron explains in this talk from his Word on Fire podcast, modern science was birthed by the church.
The modern physical sciences, in a very real sense, came from religion. They can't be in conflict with that which gave rise to them. Now, what am I talking about? First of all, a simple kind of historical fact that, without exception, all the great founders of the modern natural sciences were trained in schools and universities sponsored by the church. As you know, the whole university system came up, as John Paul II said, ex corde ecclesiae, from the heart of the church. The church sponsored the institutions where the great founders of the modern sciences learned their mathematics and learned their physics and learned their astronomy. The church, in a very real sense, was the matrix out of which the sciences came.
The notion about there's a conflict between religion and science. The fact is, if it hadn't been for religion, there wouldn't have been any science.
This is the late historian Rodney Stark speaking on the Praxis Circle podcast.
And that the men who were involved in the scientific revolution were overwhelmingly men of faith. As a matter of fact, of a group of 55 of the real superstars of the era, only one could be called irreligious. About 20 of them were actually clergy, and the rest were very, very religious men. Newton wrote a lot more theology than he did physics. Some of them gave all their money for translations of the Bible into foreign languages. Others tried to set the date of the creation. These were guys who were busy being scientists, but they were very devout Christians. And of course, the fact is that science was only possible because there was an assumption about the world, which is that it ran according to reason because it was created by a rational creator. Consequently, they believed that you could understand the universe. People in the rest of the world were taught that you can't comprehend the universe. You can think about it, you can meditate on it, but you can't account for it because it doesn't run according to any rational, reasonable, understandable rules. And of course, these people believed that it did run according to rules. More importantly, they looked for the rules and they found them.
When it comes to devout believers who spearheaded the scientific revolution, there are almost too many to choose from. To name just a few from the 17th century, we could begin with the aforementioned Francis Bacon, arguably the founder of the scientific method, along with Johannes Kepler, Robert Boyle, Isaac Newton, and Blaise Pascal. Then there were Gottfried Leibniz, Antoine Lavoisier, and Carl Linnaeus in the 18th century. Michael Faraday, James Maxwell, and Louis Pasteur are among the many from the 19th century. The history of science is replete with pioneering scientists who were devout believers. Importantly, historians of science agree that these men were not simply parroting a faith handed to them by their culture, but genuinely perceived the universe and the scientific enterprise through Christian eyes. Even the avowed atheist philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, who despised Christian belief, wrote, "There is no such thing as science without any presuppositions. A philosophy, a faith, must always be there first of all, so that science can acquire from it a direction, a meaning, a limit, a method, a right to exist. We men of knowledge of today, we godless men and anti-metaphysicians, we too still derive our flame from the fire ignited by a faith millennia old, the Christian faith." C.S. Lewis summarized it pithily when he wrote, "Men became scientific because they expected law in nature, and they expected law in nature because they believed in a legislator." But it wasn't only that belief in a law-giving God that encouraged the scientific pioneers to explore a law-abiding universe. Their Christian faith also meant they saw science as part of a God-given mission. Australian historian Sarah Irving Stonebreaker, who we met earlier in this series, began her journey moving from atheism to faith while studying for her PhD at Cambridge University in 2007. She told me that one of the discoveries that most surprised her as an atheist was just how central the faith of the scientific pioneers was to their work.
They're all Christians. I mean, that's a fairly simple way of answering this question, but they were all Christians. The interesting thing is, and this is the really important thing to understand, is that actually, far from being a hindrance, their faith in many ways, and in many different ways, the story is complicated, but in many ways, they actually pursued what we now call science, and back then, more accurate term was the philosophy of nature, natural philosophy. But they pursue it for theological reasons. I think one of the best illustrations of this, and one of the things that, to be honest, when I was a PhD student at Cambridge, and still at that time an atheist, really struck me, is this particular illustration. So, and it's really about the origins of the experimental method, right? Absolutely central to the modern experimental sciences. But the pioneers of the experimental method, and it really begins in Oxford in the 1660s, Robert Boyle at Cambridge, but also his close colleague, Robert Hooke. And the interesting thing is that one of the most important ideas that spurred them to pursue the experimental method was a sense of the effects that sin, so the fall, had not only on our moral capacities, but actually on human cognition. And basically what Hooke in particular, and Boyle and others, end up arguing is that it's precisely because human cognition is so fallen and affected by sin. We can't rely upon unaided reason to kind of intuit God's order of the universe just by reading it like a book. Nature, in fact, has to be experimented upon. We actually have to, in some ways, compensate for how tarnished our cognition is, but also how tarnished our senses are because of the fall in order to do this. And in Hooke's really famous work called Micrographia, which is a wonderful, gosh, and if you read it, you know, there are diagrams of the early microscopes. It's wonderful, but it's basically on the microscope and on the experimental method and how to use it. And in the preface to that work, published in 1665, what Hooke says is that one of the sort of the reason for needing to develop a microscope and develop this experimental method is to compensate for the profound effects of sin on the human senses. So in other words, we need to pursue nature, pursue it through this experimental method, precisely because even though there is an ordered universe and a God of order, whose order can eventually be understood, we need to do this in a way that makes sense of and kind of compensates for how profoundly affected the human senses are and human reason is by sin itself. And that idea is one of the driving forces behind the experimental method.
It'd be fascinating to hear more about the sort of the motivations of those scientific pioneers then, Sarah, and to what extent their Christian faith was fueling their sense that science and their study and contemplation of the universe was also important for moral progress, yeah, for, you know, some sense of God's kingdom, you know, being established. And
yes, that's a really fascinating idea. And in fact, I find that that's one of the most, one of the ideas that really captures when I teach the history of scientific revolutions, really captures the imagination of students, because in many ways, one of the most distinctive features of modern science is that we believe that modern science ought to have some kind of human benefit. I mean, if you look at even why one of the ways I even begin some of my classes on this is to talk about the fact that the defining feature of at least modern scientific grant applications really is, can you prove that this will actually help and improve human society? There's a kind of modern understanding, secularized now, but of progress that kind of underpins that. But the really kind of fascinating thing lying beneath this is that there was not always this sense that the study of the natural world would be connected with any kind of idea that this knowledge would contribute to a kind of profound, overarching sense of improving that world. There are particular kind of uses for things. For example, in the study of ancient astronomy, for example, and medieval astronomy, you know, can we create a church calendar? Particular uses, but this kind of broader idea that the knowledge of nature ought to be useful in some way to improving human life. And even when I use that phrase, improving human life, I'm actually quoting one of the founders of modern science there, Francis Bacon. That is a profoundly a Christian idea, which is really distinct to the foundations of modern science. It's a really Christian idea for various theological reasons. But to kind of simplify, it's this understanding that God is building his kingdom and that knowledge actually has a particularly important role to play. And indeed, if there is a kind of priesthood of all believers and all people, all Christians are kind of called to participate in the kind of building of God's kingdom, then natural knowledge plays a role in improving human life. And so Francis Bacon, one of the most important sort of 17th century natural philosophers, for various reasons and the origins of modern science, he uses this phrase, like I said, that natural knowledge ought to be used for the improvement of human life. And he even says that in the fall, humanity kind of declined from their state of innocence, both kind of morally and in terms of their knowledge, both of which can in some way be repaired in this life, the former by the Christian faith, religion and faith, and the latter by the arts and sciences. It's actually a profoundly radical and quite new application of a theological idea in the 17th century, which is, actually, we don't just contemplate the natural world, we produce knowledge that ought to be profoundly useful for human life. And the creation of practical, applied knowledge, there's a whole kind of intellectual shift that takes place, and what eventually becomes modern science has at its very core this idea that the kind of knowledge we produce ought to be useful. And that idea at its heart is a theological one.
Of course, forms of scientific advance were not limited only to Christendom. Chinese astronomers had already been mapping the sky for thousands of years. The Greeks had pioneered geometry and philosophy. The medieval Islamic world saw a flowering of mathematics in the 9th and 10th century. So why was it specifically in Europe that the modern scientific revolution really took hold, rather than developing in any of these other contexts?
Say, what is it about Christian society that makes it possible? And I think it's this kind of Goldilocks quality of the Christian God.
This is historian Tom Holland speaking to Cameron Bertuzzi about the scientific revolution as described in his best-selling book, Dominion.
If you look at, say, the Muslim God, basically, for the emergence of science, is too powerful. The Muslim God does not bind himself with laws. The Muslim God does not have an equivalent of covenants. The assumption among Muslim scholars is that, if you drop an apple from a tree, it's not because there is a law that says that the apple must drop from the tree. It's because God is intervening to ensure every time that the apple drops from the tree, because to say otherwise would to limit God's power. So, in a sense, the impetus for Muslim scholars to try and identify universal laws in the way that you get with ultimately culminating in Newtonian physics is simply not there. Conversely, if you look at the Confucian world, you don't have this sense of a kind of prime mover who structures the universe with laws. You have a sense that the cosmos is made up of all kinds of different elements that interact with one another in a kind of constantly evolving and fluid way. And the measure for that, which I include in Dominion, is the story of how the Jesuits go to Beijing in the late 16th and early 17th century. And the Jesuits go there as people who are completely au fait with the latest developments in European astronomy. Many of the Jesuits who end up in China are close associates with Galileo. They are familiar with Galileo's telescope. They're absolutely at the cutting edge. And what they find when they get to Beijing is that their understanding of how the cosmos works enables them to predict eclipses much more effectively than the mandarins at the emperor's court. And this is incredibly important because the emperor, for ideological reasons, needs to know when there are going to be eclipses, because it's his role to kind of mediate between the heavens and the earth. But the Confucian scholars are essentially unable to replicate the calculations that the Jesuit scholars are making unless they convert to Christianity. So there's a famous Chinese scholar who converts to Christianity and who essentially masters the Jesuit understanding of astronomy. But unless you have that kind of Christian idea that there's a framework of laws and that there's a kind of, these laws are universal throughout the fabric of the cosmos, it's very difficult to make sense of this revolution that is happening in the understanding of astronomy in 17th century Europe. So again, if you don't get science in China, you don't get science in the Islamic world for those reasons. You get science in the Christian world because you have that kind of Goldilocks state. The God is all powerful, but he is willing to submit himself to laws. You kind of need that before you can have something that will evolve to become what in the 19th century can be defined as science with a capital S.
I asked Professor John Lennox whether that original idea of a God who created an orderly, law-abiding universe was still relevant to science in an age where many scientists no longer believe in God.
If you go back to Galileo and Newton and so on, what was their motive for doing science? They believed it could be done. Mm. They believed there was order there. Why? Because they believed, as Lewis says in that quote I made earlier, they believed in a lawgiver, a legislator. And it was that underlying conviction that there's order that came from the Judeo-Christian tradition. In other words, all scientists are people of faith. Faith in what? Not necessarily in God, though many of them are. But all of us have to believe before we start our science that science can be done, or the universe is rationally intelligible, or more precisely, the universe is mathematically intelligible. Now, in 1961, Eugene Wigner, who won the Nobel Prize for Physics, wrote a wonderful paper called The Unreasonable Effectiveness of Mathematics. And I was very, very interested in this. On what assumption is mathematics unreasonable? Well, certainly it's unreasonable on atheistic assumptions, very unreasonable indeed. You've no right to expect it, as many scientists have pointed out. But on the assumption that there is a God who created the world and ordered it, then it's perfectly reasonable that mathematics works. And I often say, look, isn't it amazing that here's a mathematician, she's thinking in here, and she comes up with an equation and applies to the motion of an exoplanet out there, say. How does that possibly work? Well, it works because the universe out there and the mind in here, so to speak, are both the products of an intelligent creator. That makes sense. But as we've already seen, once you remove the intelligent creator, you're left to a faith that has no base in evidence. Now, here's the irony, you see. The irony is not that there's a conflict between God and science. There isn't. But there is a conflict between science and atheism. For that very reason, it undermines the rational underpinnings that we need to do science. Now, I say this is important because, first of all, it's absolutely central, and secondly, everybody can understand it.
Mm. But many of the modern inheritors of that scientistic view, people like Richard Dawkins, Peter Atkins today, they would say it's the progress of science, what we know about the universe, that makes us believe that actually it's pointing towards atheism, towards naturalism, rather than towards God. So why do they see this conflict narrative as being alive and well today when it comes to science and God?
I think one of the reasons is they don't study history enough, because if they did, they would know that between 1900 and 2000, over 65% of all Nobel Prize winners didn't believe in God. It's a bit of an exaggeration. And I think it's important. Of course, we don't settle these things by statistics, but it's important to analyze what is going on, because the underlying message of a lot of this is what we call scientism. Science is the only way to truth, and you better get used to it. And Dawkins and the late Stephen Hawking are both very strongly on that side. Now, that is plainly incorrect. I love logic as a mathematician, and the statement, science is the only way to truth, is not a statement of science, it's a statement of philosophical belief. And therefore, if science is the only way to truth, if it's true, it's false. So it's logically incoherent. And oddly, one of Dawkins' great scientific heroes, and one of mine, is Peter Medawar, who was here in Oxford, won the Nobel Prize. And one of the points he made is something that needs to be brought into the center of the discussion. That is, science is wonderful, but it has its limits. And Medawar says we're doing science no service at all if we claim that it can answer every question. It cannot even answer what he calls Karl Popper's questions, the questions of a child. Where do I come from? Where am I going? And what is the meaning of life? And he says we've got to turn to literature and so on, philosophy, for answers to these questions. The realization that science, though powerful, and I'm talking, of course, about the natural sciences, is limited, is hugely important.
as John Lennox has reminded us, the vast majority of Nobel Prize winners in the sciences during the 20th century have either identified as Christians or were from the Jewish faith. And in fact, despite public perceptions about a conflict between science and faith, the actual percentage of scientists who profess belief in God has remained relatively stable over the past 100 years. A 2009 Pew Forum survey showed that 51% of United States scientists believe in some form of deity or higher power, and the results were similar in polls conducted in 1914 and the 1990s. That's why we could compile an equally long list of believing scientists from the 20th and 21st centuries, including Arthur Eddington, Werner Heisenberg, and John Polkinghorne. Happily, with the advent of greater equality and opportunity for women in academia, we can also add many female names to the roster of believing scientists, such as mathematician Catherine Coleman Goebel Johnson, whose calculations were critical to spaceflight, and NASA astrophysicist Dr. Jennifer Wiseman, who serves as senior project scientist for the Hubble Space Telescope. When I sat down to talk to Jennifer Wiseman, she told me she didn't actually come from a scientific family, but says that her experience of being raised in church created the conditions that enabled her to pursue her academic career.
One was that we appreciated that everything in nature is God's creation, so it's good. This is a world that God intended to be good, and that therefore everything that we would study, whether it's, you know, mountains or plants or animals or stars, would be part of God's doing. And so that kind of opened the door that science should be something that honors God. The second thing was that we learned humility. I think I grew up learning, you know, just a fairly literal reading of scripture when it comes to creation and so forth, because, you know, why not? But that was kind of the take we had. But we also learned a sense of humility that God hasn't told us everything in scripture about the details of the natural world. We should be humble about scripture as well as being humble about what we learn about the natural world. And I think that helped me later on when some of the difficult questions would come up about the relationship of certain scriptural passages with what we're studying and learning in mainstream science. That sense of humility toward scripture, respecting it as God's word, and trying to understand what God's true message was intended in those scriptures helped me. And then thirdly, just the encouragement of a loving church family and a loving personal family that were willing to support me, even if I did something, you know, unorthodox, and give me the confidence. Also, my teachers in school were encouraging to us to reach high and try things. So I ended up doing kind of a non-traditional path and going to university far away to study physics and eventually astronomy, astrophysics.
I'm guessing, though, as your career progressed, you bumped into many colleagues, scientific colleagues, who didn't share your faith, or perhaps were even actively invested against it at some level, who were, you know, didn't believe there was a God. I mean, is that common in your area of work to meet people who are skeptical of God claims?
That's interesting. So certainly I've met people from across the spectrum of spiritual or religious beliefs in my professional career. Most of the scientists I interact with, who are actually practicing scientists, understand that science is really good at addressing certain kinds of questions. How do the forces of nature work? How have they worked over time? And you know, studying those types of natural forces and the makeup of our universe in that sense. But they and we understand that science just doesn't answer some of these bigger philosophical religious questions. It's not even designed to. So I have not actually experienced a lot of hostility toward faith from fellow scientists, even those who are not people of faith. Most of this, to me, seems to be coming out more in our popular culture, where there's kind of an expectation that science is somehow going to be the ultimate savior, the ultimate thing we can trust. And the only kind of legitimate truth. And that is an extrapolation that's really unwarranted from what science can and cannot do. And so when I hear, you know, people in our popular culture or commenting on social media in such a way that's using science as kind of the reason to denigrate any kind of religious faith, I just have to scratch my head, because it's not the scientists, for the most part, who are saying that.
As head of the Hubble Space Telescope project, Jennifer has spent her life exploring the vast depths of a universe billions of years old. With the help of people like Galileo, we've come a long way from believing that the Earth and us humans on it are at the center of everything. When in 1990 the space probe Voyager 1 sent back images of a tiny Earth in the vastness of space taken from a distance of 6 billion kilometers, science popularizer Carl Sagan described our home as a pale blue dot, writing, "It is a delusion that we have some privileged position in the universe. In our obscurity, in all this vastness, there is no hint that help will come from elsewhere to save us from ourselves." I asked Jennifer how she responds to those like Carl Sagan, who claim that what we know of the expanse of space only underlines how insignificant human life is in the big scheme of things.
You know, it is true that if we think of significance in terms of where we are in the universe or in space or time and how long our lifespan is, then we are very insignificant. I think we should all take a look at that pale blue dot picture that you mentioned and take a deep gulp of humility, because our planet is small and fragile, I would say. And one reason we need to be better stewards of this little planet. So significance cannot take our significance, I think, from place in space or time, because then that is, we are insignificant. But significance is a philosophical term, and I think significance can be gauged in other ways, and one of them is the fact that we are here, that we've come through this 13.8 billion year development of the universe to the point where we can have this self-contemplating life that recognizes a bit of where we've come from and how we connect to the universe. And I would say also recognizes our own fallenness. You know, people around the world recognize good and evil, and we see things going on every day in the news that we know are not right. And that to me is another piece of evidence that the gospel, that's the good news that's revealed in scripture, is true, because it acknowledges the bad news that humans, we sin. You know, we do things that are wrong. There is such a thing as right and wrong. We do things to each other that are right and wrong. We do things to other creatures that are not right, and we have a tinge of a conscience about that. But that we have come to the point in our evolution where we recognize responsibility and we yearn for a relationship with God. And those are things that you can't measure with the microscope and the telescope. So that's why I say there's many important truths that are outside the realm of what science can measure. But I do think there is this sense that I get of how the universe has progressed, the amazing things we see in the universe, and how we've come here, that I think can point to a sense of purpose in our lives and in the universe.
In future episodes of this act of our documentary series, we'll begin to open up some of the extraordinary ways that new research from science, cosmology, chemistry, and biology is revealing just how extraordinary our place in the universe is and the purpose that seems to lie behind it. As we begin to conclude today's episode, I want to turn from the abstract questions of the history of science and the workings of the universe to the very practical concerns of how advances in science can make a positive impact today. We hear a lot these days about the dangers of AI, and we'll probably dedicate a whole show to that one day. But one leading voice in this field, especially around machine learning, is Rosalind Picard, who leads a research team at MIT. Roz is very humble about her achievements, but in fact is a recent recipient of the International Lombardi Prize for Computer Science Research, which is described by many as the Nobel Prize in Computer Science. Her pioneering work in effective computing led to the development of the kind of wearable technology that's now commonplace, Fitbits and Apple Watches that can monitor your steps and heart rate. On a call for the Reenchanting podcast with me and my co-host Belle Tindall, Roz explained how she became interested in applying computer technology to this developing area.
Yes, originally we built wearable technologies so that we could understand people's affective, emotional state changes when they were in real life. We were measuring emotion, actually using this first device.
Yes, tell us what you're holding in your hands
here. This clunky old device. This device is called a scintigraph. It was developed by Manfred Kleins, who's since passed away, but he's probably most famous for his coining of the word cyborg. Manfred was using this with people pushing the button and measuring the dynamics of how you push, like when you're angry and it's kind of like the sharp thing, when you're feeling joy. And I saw that and I was like, wow, there's actually repeatable different ways people press. He was also an amazing pianist, has a fan letter from Einstein for his piano playing, among other fun facts about him.
Roz realized that the only way to really measure people's emotional and affective states was to take them out of the laboratory and put the laboratory on them in their daily life.
So we built the first wearables that could measure physiology comfortably when you left the lab. And some of them were pretty clunky, you know, big things duct taped to people's arms and antennas on our heads, transmitting data back to the lab and all this craziness. We also built some of the first wristwatch physiology sensors for heart rate, skin conductance, motion, temperature. And much later, those were commercialized by well-known companies as smartwatches. I'm wearing two that have been commercialized and cleared by FDA by a company I co-founded called Empatica, which is Italian for empathetic. And ours were built originally to capture data for research. And then we accidentally had some very surprising findings that changed the course of our work.
Roz's team began to realize that their technology for measuring emotion and stress could be put towards a unique use among people with autism who demonstrate non-typical outward signs of inward stress. Little did they know that, in fact, this new use of the wearable technology would also become a life-saving innovation.
And one day, a student in my lab wanted to borrow those sensors we built for his little brother over Christmas. And so I gave him a couple. I gave him two because I thought one might break because they were hand-built. Mm-hmm. And I was back here looking at his data on my laptop, and most of his data looked really low, like chill, kids having a great break. And I go to the next day and the data is so peaked that I thought the sensor must be broken, because we do expect a peak with stress. We have measured peaks of Boston driver stress and all kinds of qualifying exams and things here, but I'd never seen a peak that big. And after trying to figure out how the sensor was broken, I gave up because it wasn't following the usual explanations. And I'm an electrical engineer and, you know, like, should be all these things. Well, so I called him up, old-fashioned debugging. Hey, do you know what happened? How's your little brother? You know, what happened to him on this day or whatever? See, his little brother was non-speaking autistic. And I learned that his little brother had a seizure then, and that he had written down exactly that moment. And that got me curious about, you know, seizures. What, like, why is a seizure? And in this case, it was showing up on one wrist and not the other. Like, how on earth can you have enormous stress on one side of your body and not the other? You know, my left wrist is stressed today, but the rest of me is fine, you know? Well, it turns out there's interesting changes in your brain that can trigger the response that we thought was stress at a particular point on the body. So this led to a whole new line of inquiry where today, actually, this device I'm wearing is FDA cleared to detect the most dangerous kinds of seizures, the generalized tonic-clonic seizures that can kill people. And people are much more likely to to, well, they don't usually kill people, fortunately. But in the minutes following a seizure, when you think it's ended, it's very important to be with a person who's just had the seizure. Because in those minutes, changes can happen in the brain that can turn off your breathing. And if somebody's there to stimulate you, give first aid, you have a significantly higher, some numbers say 65 times odd ratio, higher probability of being alive if you're not alone at that time. So our device alerts your caregivers, gives them your GPS if you choose to share that, and hopefully they get there fast. You need to share a caregiver, let your caregivers know to how to get to you fast.
And I love the way that the technology that you're invested in is so kind of, in a sense, human-centered, Roz. It's lovely. But I know that the motivation partly comes from your Christian faith, but you've got a bit of an unusual story in that respect, because I don't think you particularly grew up with a Christian faith. How did you sort of arrive at that place as an adult?
Not easily. I guess like a lot of kids who do well in school and think they're so smart, I thought religion was for people who weren't thinking. And I thought, I mean, I just kind of arrogantly dismissed it. I just made assumptions about people that were not right. It was through meeting a family that was very intelligent. You know, he was a doctor, and I babysat for them, and they were cool, and I liked them. And they kept, like, things were going really well there. And then one day they invited me to church. Like, you go to church? Like, this just didn't fit. I didn't want to go to church, and I, you know, as the weekend came closer and they were checking in with me, I decided I was sick. I had a stomach ache. I couldn't go. Well, the next weekend they tried again and I had a stomach ache again. Now, you can only fake sickness to a doctor so long, right? Before they kind of on to you. And finally, after many weeks of my trying to get out of this, they said, you know, what matters most is not that you go to church. What matters most is what you believe. And have you read the Bible? Now, as a grade school kid who thought she was so smart, I did know of the Bible. I knew it was the best-selling book of all time. I knew how famous it was. No, I hadn't read it. I had like a gold leaf version that I didn't think you really were supposed to read. And they suggested that I start with Proverbs, one a day for a month, because I want to be well-educated and have read the Bible. You can't be well-educated if you haven't read the Bible. So I started reading Proverbs. And I was shocked that there was actually a lot of real wisdom in there, real intelligence. And so I read all of Proverbs and I started to realize maybe I was making some assumptions that weren't entirely true. And about that time, some of my friends were going through confirmation. They had a version of the Bible that was more readable that you could read through in a year. And so I decided to read through the Bible in a year. Nowhere was I going to set foot in church, but I did start closet reading the Bible every day for a year till I had read through the whole Bible. And through that process, which I then reread many times over and over, I started to believe in God, which was not what I wanted to do. So then I decided to study some other world religions to see if maybe I was just a product of reading the Bible. If I read these other religious books, maybe I would believe them too. So I was trying to kind of fix my problem of becoming a believer. So long story short, I went on quite a journey for many years, reading, exploring, visiting, meeting people from lots of faith traditions, trying to figure out this stuff. And I went from believing in God to finally early in college, accepting Jesus as the as not just somebody I started to believe what he said, not just as a great teacher, but giving him a much bigger role in my life, where I realized it was pretty pretty amazing if you could actually hand over the reins. So I did that.
Was the scientific part of you sort of kicking against that to any degree? And I guess among your intellectual peers, was that seen as a sort of, oh dear, you've obviously, you know, had a moment of illogicality here, Roz, where you're believing these ancient myths and things? I mean, was is actually religious belief not so uncommon among the scientific community? Is that
There are lots of brilliant scientists who have deep religious and especially Christian belief. I'd say Jewish and Christian, and Muslim here. We have a lot of faculty and leaders at MIT who are not just like superficial belief because they were raised this way, but have adopted faith later after much reason, after much reflection, after very rigorous thinking. And in fact, if you go over and look at the main court of MIT, where, you know, these big imposing buildings, architecture with names etched in it, like Newton and Kepler and Faraday, you'll find a lot of these great scientists were not just Christians because people were Christians around them. They wrote more, like Newton wrote more about his Christian faith than about the calculus and the science. He was extremely thoughtful about it. So you'll find a lot of people really engaging and thinking through these in science. However, as a grade school kid, my notion of science was very superficial. I kind of believed this bipolar, like it's science or it's God. You can't have both. And in fact, that's just so completely broken, right? Such a naive and poorly understood fake dichotomy.
The more you've looked into the inner workings of human brains and our bodies and all of those, then that has fed into your faith, because actually, mm-hmm. you know, this holistic sort of deep dive into humanity has then sort of done the reverse as well.
Absolutely. In fact, that used to be the first thing I would say when asked about faith and the science, is the more we ask questions and learn, It's not at all like grade school where there's just an answer in the back of the book and you're done on to the next question. In science, you ask a question, you get an answer, and it opens up 15, 20 new questions, each one which opens up more. As people know, like from looking at a microscope, you need an even more powerful microscope. There's always something deeper, whether you're going smaller or whether you're going larger. It's jaw-dropping. It's awesome. One neurologist I met with at an epilepsy conference recently pulled me aside, and he said he was starting to become a Christian. And I said, you know, what happened? And he said, well, in addition to reading and researching a lot of things, he's just been consistent. He goes inside people's brains, you know, and measures and does stuff. And he's just been so consistently blown away by how amazing the mind is. The more he learns about it, the more awe, the more reverence for what how we are made. And I find that all the time. It's just amazing that our bodies and brains work, you know, as well as they do. And by the way, I'm speaking as somebody who got a cancer diagnosis recently and has just gone through treatment. And I still am blown away by how well, as you learn the mechanisms our bodies use to repair things, it's astonishing. It is so complex. It is just jaw-dropping.
Can I ask you about that then, in particular, how your work and your research and just your general sort of scientific sort of leaning mind, how that has been fueled by your faith, but also how that, on also vice versa, how that has then fed back into your faith?
Yeah, I haven't found any conflicts between science and my faith. I did think there were some in third grade while I was an atheist, but I haven't found them as a practicing scientist, as somebody who reads science for fun on the side. Okay. I have found my faith, however, influences significantly how I choose to do certain things and what I choose to do.
Okay.
What sort of things would you say it's made a difference in that sense then? I mean, do you anticipate you might have gone in a different direction in terms of your research and mm-hmm. so on?
Yeah, and it's interesting also on the topic of AI, because originally what was cool that drew me to AI was, you know, can you build a machine that can do everything the human mind can do, right? That can do everything we can do. And there were lots of reasons to do that, right? One is this egotistical, like we just want to build something that is so far better than us that, as my colleague Marvin Minsky said, we'll be lucky if it keeps us around as household pets. Now, you know, all these great people in AI were saying that. And so, you know, they attract a lot of people to work on that. But if you really sit back and think about, do I really want my legacy, my grandchildren to say, it's because of my grandma that we are all like reduced to no status in this world. I'm like, you know, I think we need to rethink this. There are other cool reasons to do it, right? Because the more that you try to understand the mind and you try to synthesize and build things, the better the questions you ask about it, the more you model something well, the more you understand it, the more useful those models can be for health and lots of other important things that actually dignify human beings and are good for us. So there are really good reasons to do it that can affirm and support humanity. And sometimes the work looks the same in those cases, but it's just very much the framing and the purpose and what you're doing with it that is different. So I was drawn to understanding how the human mind worked and was trying to build that. I still am drawn to that, but I realized in doing that, that we could be doing so much good for people in the world, not just for our resumes and for our publication. Mm. Some young people are like, oh, I just want to do this thing that makes it easy to get published. Mm. Mm. I realized from scripture that we're supposed to be helping those who aren't so strong, who are where there's injustice. We're supposed to be getting rid of injustice. We're supposed to be doing things that, you know, with the people that nobody around me even knows. But some of these people don't go to church. They never meet anybody who's not like them, super smart, well-educated, all that stuff. But in my church community, I meet the homeless, I meet the poor, I meet people who really have it tough in life. I meet lots of people who are disabled, lots of foster families and youth, and they're being left out. They, you know, the superpowers of this technology that are making the rich richer and the smart smarter, like, could be rectifying a lot of the injustice in the world. And nobody, very few people were like thinking about that. So I was feeling challenged that I need to step off my easy, like, just make a name for yourself, keep doing this cool machine learning path, and try to do things that actually help other people. And that was something directly challenged by my faith. As one of the pastors used to say, actually, this was a priest used to say, that the role of the church was to comfort the afflicted and to afflict the comfortable. Mm. And I was feeling, I've been quite afflicted by what I've read in the scriptures many times. Mm.
I was genuinely moved by our conversation with Rosalind Picard, not only as a living example of a rebirth of belief in God happening among leading scientists today, but someone who stands in the footsteps of those first pioneers who saw the science they practiced as a gift from God to bring the kingdom of heaven to earth. Of course, as the history of the 20th and 21st century has shown, that's not the way science has always been used, as nations, tyrants, and big business interests have used technology for selfish and even tyrannical purposes. As last year's Oscar-winning film Oppenheimer reminded us, we have created the capacity to eradicate ourselves using science. But as we'll hear in future episodes of this act of our series, I believe a new generation of scientists, thinkers, and pioneers are waking up to the fact that as science reveals more about the nature of the universe we live in and the extraordinary complexity of a human species that is able to do science, it's reviving a belief in purpose, design, and even a mind behind it all that may hold the clue to how we can truly live in harmony with the world around us. You've been listening to The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God, telling the story of how New Atheism grew old and secular thinkers are considering Christianity again. Material from The Unbelievable Show was used by permission of Premier. Visit premierunbelievable.com for full shows or today's show notes for links to all archive materials used in this episode. And just to remind you, this podcast series is also a book. You can read the first chapter for free when you join my newsletter at justinbriley.com, where you can also order the book or get a signed copy. Supporting via Patreon or tax-deductible giving from the USA will give you early access to new episodes of the podcast and access to bonus content. Find out more and how to support my efforts to bring thinking faith to the secular and Christian world at justinbriley.com. The links are with today's show. Coming up next time.
I mean, if somebody was going to convince me of the need for a god, it would be there. Origin of the physical constants. Now that's getting warm, that's getting close to a good argument.
Find out why our extraordinary Goldilocks universe gives even someone like Richard Dawkins pause for thought. Today's episode was a production of Think Faith in partnership with Genexis and with support from the Jerusalem Trust. Editing assistance by Isaac Simmons. You can find links to the book and all our featured guests with the show notes. Please do subscribe to this podcast, do rate and review us and tell others too. Share it on your social media. It all helps others to find us. And you can get the next episode that you just heard a clip from 2 weeks early when you support now at justinbriley.com. Once again, the link is with today's show. See you next time. Thanks for listening. Just before I let you go, I had this lovely review from Chrissy saying, "So good. I've literally consumed this podcast in 3 days. I've sent it to all my friends from various backgrounds. I pray you guys continue the amazing work and keep those episodes coming." Leaving a review like Chrissy really helps others to discover the show. But if you'd really like to help me keep those episodes coming, why not consider supporting the show or buying the book that this podcast is based on? The links are with today's show. Or visit justinbriley.com. See you at the next episode.